Club New Life family. It's Becky Brown with your November Collective. I am so grateful for this opportunity just to check in with you and to say hello and to say thank you. I don't think we have to wait for Thanksgiving or November to express our gratitude for each and every one of you. Our Club New Life family is our incredible family of people who love what we do and want others to know about the hope that is in Christ and in really good counseling. And that's what you all are. We're so grateful. I'm just thankful for each and every one of you. Just a quick reminder that on November 9th, we're going to have our Club New Life Zoom. We're going to do it on a Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific time, 11 a.m. Eastern time. And we're going to hear from Chris Williams, who's going to speak to us about abundance versus scarcity. So you can also get caught up on the latest things that are happening here at New Life, and we'll have time where we can hear from you. We love this opportunity to connect with you. It's face-to-face, technologically provided by Zoom, of course, but we're so grateful just as a time to meet with you and look forward to seeing you there. Sign up for the free Zoom by going to clubnewlife.com and registering, or you can call 1-800-NEW-LIFE or 1-800-639-5433, and we'll get you connected. Just as a reminder, our New Life video library has over 600 videos on all different kinds of topics, featuring many of our co-hosts, some of our special guests, and they range from 3 minutes to 15 minutes. Everybody's got a little time to learn something new, and it's just an opportunity for you to check those out. So you can check it out at clubnewlife.com, or you can find some of those on our YouTube channel, New Life Ministries. And I would love for you to click like and subscribe on our YouTube channel. Many of you I know are going there for other kinds of things, whether it's music video or preaching, but I'm sure you will be surprised at all the videos that we have there for you to learn and to grow in your faith and also in your emotional and mental health journey. You are a blessing to each and every one of us here at New Life. We're so grateful for you. And you are going to hear some great teachings today, but we're going to start off from a teaching on blessings by Jim Burns.
Hi, I'm Jim Burns, and I'm pleased to talk with you about something that we probably don't talk enough about. How do we bring a blessing to our families? You know, Kathy and I were in a small group. We kind of raised our kids together with this small group. There were, I think, seven couples, and our kids were about second grade through, well, actually some even going into the teenage years. And we were in this group for a long time. One of the times, I was actually leading that day, and I asked this question, how many of you received a blessing from your parents? And nobody really knew what that meant, and including me in some ways. But also, there were tears. Because there were people who said, I never received that blessing, and I'm not sure I've given that blessing to my family. So let's talk about blessings and bringing honor and security to your home. The Bible talks a lot about blessing. You know, and it's really a religious word, but blessing is a beautiful word. And the way I want to describe the word blessing is, well, just give you 4 points on how to give a blessing to someone in your family. Number one is we speak the blessing. Your words have power. In fact, I was talking to somebody recently who said, my dad said, you'll never amount to anything, and you're just a no-good bum. And guess what? For many years, that was a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that's the direction that he went until he had a committed conversion to Christ and changed his mindset. And it can be a change of mindset. Some of you may need that. But the point I'm saying here is that your tongue, this is in James, your tongue has the power to both bless and curse. And what I'm saying is speak blessings to your kids. Bless them whenever you possibly can. I find that blessing is affirming them. Blessing is bringing encouragement. Somebody once said, I can live 2 months on one good compliment. That's actually Mark Twain. Jesus did this. He blessed the disciples. He blessed people by speaking blessings over them. You know, I even got to a place when my kids were in college where I would send them a blessing. I would take a scripture and I would just say, hey, I wanted to send this to you today as a form of a blessing. And so again, you speak blessings to your kids, to your family, to anybody without even necessarily using the word blessing. Secondly, is you believe the blessing. So especially if you have children, your children need you to believe in them. And again, your children could be 36 years old or 40 or 50 or 8. But even with grandkids, I think it's important for us to believe the blessing. Life is hard. And truly, we need to have the power of belief. There are times when I honestly think that some parents who are blessing their kids and giving them honor and security are parents who are carrying them because, again, they're giving them that belief. Now, if you have a son who's in high school and he's 4'11", you don't believe him to be a National Basketball Association, you know, leader, because he's not going to be a National Basketball Association leader. He's not, that's not what he's at 4'11", he's not going to do that. But we believe in their character. We believe in their faith. We believe in their who they are as a person. We believe that God can use them in great ways. And oftentimes when I'm talking with students, and my background is youth ministry, and I would talk to students and I would say, you know, what's got you to here, this place? You're an amazing person. They'd say, you know, it was that praying grandma who believed in me. It was that dad who said, you know what, you had a bad day, but we're going to make this better. And I believe in you, son. Those are the important things. So you speak the blessing and you believe the blessing. Thirdly, is you be the blessing, right? You're a role model. I went to a Christian college. Really, I had just become a Christian. I was not raised in a Christian home, and I was 16. I became a Christian, went to a school right after that in college, 17 and a half, I think I went to college. And I remember there was a bald-headed, nerdy missionary who was giving us chapel, which I laugh at because I now look like that missionary, I'm sure. And he looked out at the audience. He didn't say a joke. He didn't open with scripture. He just said, "You're the only Jesus somebody knows." Pause. And then he said it again. "You're the only Jesus somebody knows." Now, I'll be honest with you. I was doing my homework in the back, right, during that time. But I was intrigued, and so I looked up, and on the 10th time, he said it 10 times, he looked at me and he said, "You're the only Jesus somebody knows." And you know what happened? It was as if God was speaking to me, because not being raised in a Christian home, having a lot of people in my life who are not Christian, I almost heard God say through a still, small, quiet voice, "You're representing Christ to a group of people that do not know him." So when they're checking in on what Christ is going to do and how Christ would care and love, they're going to check in with you. Now, that's not putting a lot of pressure on as much as it is just being that authentic person. And I found that with my, even with my own kids, that it was important for me to understand that I had to be the role model. My wife, she was laughing one day when our little daughter Heidi was very young, because she was reading a Star Wars magazine and it was upside down. And so she couldn't read. She was too little. And I said to her, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Votions." And I said, "What?" She goes, "I'm doing votions." And I said to Kathy, who knew how to speak child language better than me, what did she say? She goes, "I think she says she's doing her devotions." Well, you know what was interesting? That's exactly the chair that Kathy does every day, her devotions. There's a cup of coffee. There's her Bible. There's a devotional. And that's what she's done all of these years. Well, guess what? Little Heidi back then was imitating. She was a role model. Becca, my middle child, she was praying one time, and we prayed with the kids every night, and there were times when they got to be a certain age, they didn't always want to pray, and we said to Becca, I think she was 14, 15, 16, something, "Becca, do you want to pray tonight?" And she said, "Okay, I'll pray." And then she said, "Dear Daddy," and then she giggled, and she goes, "I mean, dear God." And Kathy leaned over to me and said, "You know, her God looks like a bald-headed nerdy guy," not meaning that I'm replacing God, but that I'm representing, you know, faith to them, and you're representing faith to people, and you do that by being a role model. That doesn't mean that you have to be perfect. The Bible says that the man or woman of integrity walks securely. What I want to say to you is the man or woman of integrity who walks securely will have kids who walk securely, will have a spouse who walks securely, will have others around them who walk securely because of your integrity. Integrity doesn't mean perfection. It means that you're a role model, that you're living life with authenticity. And then lastly, you celebrate blessings. So that's how you do blessings. You celebrate blessings. You celebrate birthdays. At our family, every birthday is celebrated with saying three good things around a table. We have a dinner. Sometimes it's not on this, with our family growing, it's not always on the same day of their birthday, but we have a dinner. And then each person shares what we call affirmation bombardment, and that's celebrating a blessing. We give them a blessing, if you would. And so it's important to do that. We have a program called Pass It On at the ministry I'm a part of, and it starts at kindergarten. It goes through 12th grade. And so what it is it's celebrating their rites of passages. So what are their rites of passages? With a kindergartner, it's an invitation to generosity. And so we invite that kindergartner to figure out how, as a family, they can be generous. The co-writer of the book, Pass It On With Me, his name is Jeremy Lee. His son, when he was in kindergarten, actually said, we need to feed homeless people, and then we also need to help them be warm. So Jeremy, cost him some money, spent $150, went to Walmart, bought $150 worth of blankets, and then they actually, with a ministry, passed it out in Nashville, Tennessee, where they're from. What a great learning lesson. One of those blankets was on the wall of his son. It's still there, and his son is a lot older now than being a kindergartner, right? So at 7th or 8th grade, it's teaching them healthy sexual integrity. At 18, when they're seniors, it's having a manhood ceremony or a womanhood ceremony. And so it's those kinds of things that you do that can make a difference. So we're going to speak the blessing, we're going to believe the blessing, we're going to be the blessing, and then we're going to celebrate blessings with our family. You know what? It makes a difference, and it makes a difference that can change the trajectory of your family.
Chris, JJ, and I recently addressed Rachel's concern that her mother-in-law triggers her during the holidays. Well, actually, every day. And then Mark Cameron will share a teaching on emotional triggers and reactivity.
We're going to talk with Rachel, who's calling us from Denton, Texas, listens on KWRD. Hi, Rachel. I'm glad you called today. How can we help you?
Thank you. I have a question. I have a mother-in-law that's a little proud, in my opinion. And so with that said, I have autoimmune disease, and she's really been triggering me. And I've tried so hard to, like, do different things. And I've even offered, like, hey, maybe counseling would really, really help with, like, this relationship. And it's just a no, no, no. Like, and it's to the point where I needed surgery, and long story short, my blood work kept getting bad from stress. Mm. And I finally said, enough. I said, on Thanksgiving, I lasted maybe 5 minutes. And I said, I can't deal with this stress. I have surgery on Friday, and I've really got to keep my stress level down. And I walked away. Mm. But this is ongoing for 15 years. And at what point, I want to be respectful. And it's really not my job. I know my husband kind of needs to step in and do stuff. But
Well, it's his mom. Know. That's why it's mm-hmm. it's tricky. Well, Rachel, let me ask you this.
She's controlling, yeah.
Let me ask you this. Like on a regular basis, how much contact are you having with her? Is it just holidays? Do they live down the street? What is your regular connection with her?
She lives across the street, but now my regular connection with her is only holidays. Because of just the dynamics that have taken place throughout the years.
Yeah. Well. Having your mother-in-law holidays live across the street could cause some problems, maybe. I don't know. Chris, JJ?
Yes.
Yeah, so Rachel, if I want you to pay attention to your body really quickly between your chin and your belly button, and I want you to then picture your mother-in-law. And where mm-hmm. in your body do you feel sensation, maybe a strong physical reaction, when you picture her?
In my heart.
Okay, stay there. If your heart had a message about you, maybe an I am statement, what would that say?
I am enough.
Okay. Now,
like towards her.
Yes, because what she most likely triggers inside of you is that you are not enough.
Right.
Okay.
But that's her, not me.
Can I challenge you on that?
Sure.
It is you.
No.
So what I'm saying is this. It's like she triggers that. And she may even say you're not enough. And she probably, you know, if I'm going to give you a cheat code here, the people who carry not enough inside of them constantly put it on other people. They project it on other people, right? Mm-hmm. But the only right. people that absorb it is those who have not enough inside of them.
Right. But so, she's just nasty. Like, it's I do feel enough. Like, I feel happy, and she's really the only person that, like, triggers me because she's just so unkind. And she tries to control my husband, and I'm like, babe, you're a grown man. You don't have to listen to her.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I want to encourage you to keep doing is that as you picture her unhooking that place in your heart that says not enough. And again, I'm not saying that this, right, because you can't change her behavior, but you can change your reaction to her.
Okay.
Where this sounds harsh, but it's not meant to be. It's the difficulty of an internal boundary is that she has to mean less to you. Her actions and her behavior have to mean less to you.
Right.
Right. Okay. Now, there's other conversations and other behaviors around. Again, I think you're already moving in that direction around setting boundaries around her, you know, and negotiating the relationship and probably some marital stuff that needs to be addressed as well.
Well, and I think what you're talking about, Chris, just Rachel, think about this for a minute. You're talking about she's in a state of reactivity.
Yes.
And that's the reason why it's still in you, Rachel, that you're not enough.
Yeah, because I'm paying attention to the autoimmune response. I'm paying attention to the cortisol.
Right. Well, and it used to not be like that. It's gotten worse throughout the years. You know, we used to like go at it and I would just let her have it because it's just not like that's just not in my nature to let somebody walk over me.
JJ, I wanted you to speak into that whole dynamic of what she was talking about with her mother-in-law and just those family dynamics that occur. I mean, a lot of people have that struggle. What would you say to Rachel about this situation?
Yeah. So a couple of things come to mind. Number one is if Rachel, you're still listening, I hope you hear from us. We're so sorry that you're having to have such a hard time and have had such a hard time with your mother-in-law for so long. That's so hard to be in a situation where someone that close to you, right, that has access to your life, has an agenda that is painful, has an agenda that is destructive. And so I'm so sorry that you're going through that, especially because you've made some efforts to try to improve the relationship. You've invited her to work together with you to improve. And I appreciate the fact that you've done that. And truth is, scripture says, as much as it is up to you, live at peace with all people, right? Romans 12, but it gives us that caveat. It doesn't say just blanket, live at peace with all people. It says as much as it is up to you. So part of our own healing is recognizing where my responsibility stops and theirs begins and not taking on their responsibility as my own. The other thing that I would encourage is I think that there needs to be a series of conversations with your husband. You know, if you were still on, I would be asking questions like, okay, so how does your husband respond when you say, hey, I really need more help and support?
Well, and she is on JJ.
So she is.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Rachel, I would love to hear from you. How does your husband respond when you say things like, hey, I need more help and support from you to set and hold these healthy boundaries with your mother?
He's actually done really good the last 2 years. He got sober and now he does support me 100%. But sometimes he goes overboard and he's like, you know what? I don't want to be around her either. She's, you know, I have all this trauma from her from when I was a child because we've done a lot of work to break those cycles. Mm-hmm. And he's like, why do you make me have a relationship with her? And I'm like, well, that's your mom. You need to not you can't just cut her out like that. He's like, why? You can't. I want to also. And I'm just like, that's not healthy. That's not a healthy mindset.
Well, it depends. I think it depends though, Rachel, on whatever he's talking about. I mean, if there's, there's a lot of people that have to manage mom and dad relationships in a strong boundary like that, but it's never in reaction. You know, you make a decision from repeated experiences based on, I need to have that peace. But go ahead, JJ. I know you got another question for her, but
I would agree with you, Becky. It doesn't need to be reactionary, but there are times where when we've had a calm assessment of the situation, we may need to say, I've got to set this line because my interactions with you, whenever I do interact with you, it is distractive. It is detrimental, right? And so I may need to say, no, I can't. I have to limit how much interaction I have with you. Well, so I would encourage, Rachel, you to at least talk with your husband about if he's saying, I want to cut her off, maybe the boundary line needs to be moved. Maybe it's not cut her off completely, but maybe it's we need to reset the boundaries. Maybe we need to not have her live right across the street.
Right.
I don't know
who
lived there first.
right.
I don't know if you guys moved next to her or she moved next to you, but maybe we need to expand that buffer.
Right. No, she actually followed me. That was a funny question because I had bought the property earlier and she had asked, is that fine if I buy the property next door and buy on it? And I'm like, what am I supposed to say? No.
Well, you can.
I know I should have.
Well, but you know what, though, Rachel, here's the thing is that you obviously have an influence on her. And even though it's adversarial at this point, and that's kind of the knot that's tied right now, because I know everybody's wondering, why in the world would you live across the street? But if she moved there, then, you know, that's another thing. But I just think you can manage this relationship you have up to this point. It's just made you sick in the process. And I think that's the thing you got to be paying attention to.
Okay.
JJ, Chris, anything else?
Okay, Rachel, I got to point one thing out. Okay, so hear me out, my friend. You're struggling with a lot of control. You know, you're saying to your husband, hey, stand up for me. Oh, not like that. Okay? So that put, you know, and so my guess is that your husband is maybe a little bit of a pleaser in there. And pleasers, when they please for too long and it doesn't work, they do cut off. I know, because I'm one of those. And you're right. There are some things that are unhealthy in that. But what I want you to be able to pay attention to is the anxiety that you're carrying inside of you as the result of the actions of other people. And of course, that's very natural. But what we want to be able to do as we're getting healthy, especially as you need to take care of your body and your soul and your mind with an autoimmune disease, is learn what can I do, live within my limitations, and really learn a little bit. The skill of boundary making is really tough. But let me give you a clue. A boundary isn't a request for somebody to do something different. A boundary is something I'm going to do as a result of something that needs to keep me safe and me protected.
That's so helpful. Thank you.
Good. Yes.
Good. We are going to send you a copy of Boundaries. It is the Bible for those decisions that you're talking about. And we're glad that you called today, Rachel.
Hello and welcome to New Life. My name is Mark Cameron. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist and co-host on New Life Live. Today I want to talk to you about emotional triggers and reactivity. What is an emotional trigger? Well, an emotional trigger is any type of stimulus that elicits strong emotions and sets in motion a reactivity pattern. Okay, the stimulus is a reminder or an association to a past event for us. And so what happens is typically if we have any kind of significant event, for instance, like a car accident, especially if I thought that I was in danger of losing my life, that would impact me. And my brain would remember that going forward. Or if we have repeated experiences with a significant person, such as with a parent, and how we learn how to react to that parent, that gets coded into our brains, and we repeat that over and over again. So reactions are actually unconscious, meaning that we don't really think about them before we do them. They are reactions, repeated actions that we perform over and over again. Sometimes reactivity is anger. Other times it's blame. Some of us dismiss and avoid as a way not to feel. And others of us please to try and make anxiety go away for us. Okay, so it's important to understand how we work as human beings. So as human beings, we are very purposeful in our actions and behaviors. We do not do things randomly. So all of our actions are driven by an emotion or a feeling, okay? So I know a lot of times we'll use the words emotions and feelings interchangeably. So for this explanation here, I'm going to say that feelings are bodily feelings. I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I'm tired, and emotions are I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm mad. Okay, so for instance, if I were to be looking in the fridge, this is my action, I'd be feeling hungry likely, and I would need food. If I were to be stretching and yawning, I'd be feeling tired and likely need sleep or rest. Okay, so those are bodily feelings. Let's talk about emotions here. If I or a little kid and I'm hiding underneath the bed, I likely feel scared and I need safety, security, and protection to take away my fear. If I was at school sitting by myself, everyone's sitting with their friends, I likely would be feeling lonely and I'd need companionship. And if I was pacing around, biting my nails, maybe I'm feeling nervous, anxious, or worried. And if I feel worried, I need reassurance. I need someone to say to me, hey, Mark, everything's going to be okay. Or if they don't know everything's going to be okay, I need them to tell me, you know what? I'm going to be here with you. I need that kind of reassurance, okay? So that's how we work as human beings. But what happens if we don't get our need met? If we don't get our need met, then we start to think of different actions, different behaviors to get those needs met. So for instance, if I was hungry and I was looking in the fridge and there was no food, I wouldn't open the door to the fridge again. I'd figure out where I needed to get food. I'd go to the grocery store. I'd go to a fast food restaurant. And the same thing happens with our emotions. If, for instance, I don't feel heard, then I might learn to raise my voice to become heard, right? And that's what I learn to do, and that's what I get conditioned to do. Or if I just don't get heard, if raising my voice doesn't work, then I just might feel hopeless, and I might just give up and dismiss and avoid, right? Because if I lived in a place of famine and there was no food, what could I do? I'd become hopeless and feel despair. Okay, so now this sounds like it's bad news, but the Bible says that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, right? And because God's designed us in this amazing way, he's built into us, our brain design, a hard wiring system to adapt to life circumstances, right? And so in our brains, we have a small part called the amygdala, and the amygdala is our emotion center. And that's what the part of the brain that helps us respond or react to emotions. Now, typically, if we just went with the amygdala response, it would most likely be a reaction. So what we need to learn to do is we need to learn how to turn on the front part of our brain called the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is the thinking CEO or the mission control center of our brains. And so what we want to do is we don't want to get rid of our feelings altogether. We want to integrate those two things. We want to integrate the thoughts and we want to integrate the emotions together so that we can take an integrated approach. So I mentioned reactions and responses, okay? So how do we get good at anything? Well, we have to practice to get good at anything, right? That's called conditioning. Right. And in neuroscience, we call that neural pathway building. OK. And so what's the difference between a reaction and a response? OK, so a reaction I mentioned was unconscious. It's something that we do without thinking about it. So, for instance, someone threw an apple at me or a ball at me, I'm going to react in a certain way. If I don't see it coming, I'm going to move out of the way and I'm going to dodge it, or maybe I'll catch it. Right? But I'm not going to think about it. I'm not really going to think about what's being thrown at me. I'm just going to do one or two things with it, right? And so reactions are unconscious, but responses are conscious, right? Responses are ways that we think about the individual situation and what's the most adaptive thing to do in this individual situation, okay? And, you know, there's a reason why we call those who help us first responders and not first reactors, right? I don't know about you, but I don't want to first react to showing up when I need help. I want to first respond to showing up. Sadly, many of us are first reactors. I know that I am, and I have had to work hard to learn how to not react and how to respond instead. And in trying to figure out how to do that, I've had to figure out my childhood wounds, my patterns, and figure out what it is that I did to learn how to react and how that's not helping me now. You see, because when we're younger, we end up in this one up, one down position, right? We're kids and we don't have as much power and responsibility in relationships. And so the reactions that happen to us are actually adaptive because that's what we know how to do. That's what's within our control. However, 2 decades of conditioning that way, it's not easy to shake. And then when we get into adulthood, we move from this to this peer relationship where we have more power and more responsibility. However, we tend to go with the conditioning and we react and we do what we've learned how to do. And it's not always adaptive. In fact, it's a lot of the time it's destructive. And so the first thing we need to learn how to do is to not react. And so learning how to recognize your reactivity pattern, like I mentioned earlier, whether it's blame, whether it's anger, whether it's avoidance, whether it's pleasing to appease, we need to first recognize what it is that we're doing and then learn when that starts and learn how to pause and stop doing that. Next, right, what that does is that stops the amygdala, the emotion center, from taking control and taking over. And it helps us pause long enough to engage the mission control thought center, the prefrontal cortex. And that helps us then to be able to integrate these two responses. We can recognize that we are feeling a certain emotion, right, and acknowledge that. For some of us, that's really hard to do. And so what I like to do is I like to use a list of emotions. The list that I like to use is the SOWAS list developed by Milan and Kay Yurkovich, and you can find that on their How We Love website for free. But if you don't have that, you can Google any type of emotions list. Really, it's just the prompt. And if we can figure out what it is that we're feeling, we can often then figure out the corresponding need, right? If I feel unseen, I need to be seen. If I feel unheard, I need to be heard. If I feel worried, I need reassurance, right? And if we can figure those things out, we can learn then to verbalize what it is that we're feeling and then ask for the corresponding needs. Because we do one of two things with our emotions. We either talk them out or we act them out. Or another way that I like to say is we either verbalize or we dramatize, right? And if we dramatize, then people have to guess what it is that we need. But if we verbalize, it's a lot more clear and it's easier for them to respond. So we have many resources at New Life that can help you uncover these reactivity patterns and learn how to respond rather than react. Many of the books that we mention on New Life Live are going to be very helpful for you. We also put on workshops throughout the year. Those are going to be very beneficial. And so I hope this has been helpful for you, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Our next segment focuses on Joan's response to a brother who is mean in every sense of the word. Then we'll respond to James's concern that his fiancée is enmeshed with her parents. After that, Sherry Keffer will share a short message on boiling pot relationships, followed by J.J. West's thoughts on emotional freedom.
We're going to go back to the phones. We're going to Joan in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, listening on YouTube.
Hi, yes. I just had a little bit of a little question here. I did call about this issue back in June, and I just want to say that I love you guys so much. All of you, you just, it's amazing. I feel like you're my friends. I don't really know you, but I listen every day.
Well, come to California and hang out. You can come in studio. You can, you know, watch us as we're in here. Yeah, yeah. We'd love to hang out.
Oh my God, I would love that. Maybe one day. You never know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, but you guys were so very helpful and wise and understanding. I had a situation with, we lost our son back in April of 2021.
Wow.
Yeah.
How old was he?
He was 41.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, he was 41. It's just myself, my husband, and him. And my youngest brother, who's the only brother I have left, wrote a horrible letter to me. He's been very verbally abusive to my husband and to myself for many years, and we just kind of put up with it and put up with it and put up with it. He, in the letter, the worst thing that he said a lot of nasty things. The worst thing he said was, you never cared about him. You just let him die. You left him alone. You should have checked up on him.
Wow.
So it was just awful.
Wow.
Yes, awful. Awful, awful. Mm. And Chris, you had mentioned that, I mentioned something about, I think he's a narcissist, and you said, I'm going to take it a step further than that, and you said, well, he's dangerous. He's foolish, and he's dangerous, mm-hmm. and Dr. Jackie was there at the time, and she said, this is not the type of person that you want standing over you if, God forbid, you end up in an ICU ward or something, you know. And yeah, so I have not had any contact with him. It's probably going to be about a year now, because around Thanksgiving of last year, this is when he actually came over after the letter was sent. I had him over here for a little bit. He didn't even show remorse or anything, and he twisted everything around and made it like about, yeah, you said this about this person. He didn't even, yeah. So I haven't had any contact, and I took your advice right away. Like, he's dangerous. I don't want anything to do with him. But it still grieves my heart.
Yes.
You know, because, yeah, he's the only brother I have left. All my other brothers have passed on. My parents have passed on. Yeah, so it's just really weird. It's just such a weird...
He sounds like such an angry person.
Yes.
And like, he hasn't dealt with his issues from childhood and from the family.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Right? I mean, to blame someone who has lost a child of any age.
It's the ultimate of cruelty.
It's so cruel.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And, I, you know, we hate for family members to have to be separated and to not be in relationship. Yeah. But you can only be in relationship to the degree that you feel safe.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Yep. I totally agree. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel safe around. I never really did. And now I absolutely will not subject myself or my husband, you know, to that, to being around him. Yeah. So I just wanted to get you guys, you know, insight into that.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the really challenging aspects of this, Joan, I actually talk about this a lot because it's been my experience. The dad I needed is not the dad I got.
Yeah.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
The brother you need right now is not the brother you got. Mm-hmm. And so there is what we refer to as a living grief. And the living grief is that I'm losing that which I never had.
Hmm. Oh, wow.
And I'm not going to get.
Nope.
But there's this other person who has the title who can't fulfill the role.
Yeah.
Right. The job description of brother, he cannot fulfill, but he has the title.
But because he's there, our mind wants him to fulfill it. Right.
Yes, exactly.
Because that's what a brother is supposed to do.
Yeah.
Right. In a healthy situation. Mm-hmm. But this is a brother that I would almost call him mentally ill.
I think that they're.
Yeah.
I remember talking to you, Joan. I remember that. It was like, there some narcissism? I'm like, there's some sociopathy going on here. There's some really dangerous things that are happening that really concern me for safety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Joan, I want to say something to you. I want to say that you're not defined by your brother's words. Yeah. Sometimes when people say not only just hurtful things, but dangerous things, you know, we begin to define ourselves as that. Well, you know, maybe he's right. Maybe he's not. You know what? He's not right.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're not defined by his words. And we have to do the work within our own soul to understand that. But we're really defined by the words of God and the words of people who love us and our loving community around us. And I'm sure there were people, even in that very tough time with your son back in 2021, who came around you. Well, listen to those words. Mm-hmm. But you're not defined by your brother's words. And you can't be. And again, I'm sorry that your brother is like this, but to lower your expectations, to be honest, you're probably never going to have the loving relationship that you would hope for with a brother.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that just doesn't work. So you lower the expectations, but please hear that you're not defined by his words.
Well, and also the fact that he was probably really angry that your son died, as well as all of the rest of your family, I'm imagining. Yeah. And how he's dealing with it, though, sounds very different than how you're dealing with it. And so in his anger and upset, he's lashing out and blaming. Yeah. And that keeps him stuck.
Yeah. You know, I see it over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Unresolved, unprocessed grief leaks out.
Yep.
And it doesn't, and it leaks out in toxins.
Yeah. And it snowballs.
Absolutely.
Right? Each grief snowballs.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many, addictive processes that I've treated over the years that can be traced back to unresolved grief.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
You know, and
so. Oh, my goodness. Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good lesson for us, Chris, because a lot of us don't know how to deal with our grief.
No.
And so even in a situation, the healthiest thing that, Joan, you can do is continue the process of getting, healed through the kind of grief that you do have, not the kind of grief that he laid on you, but the your own grief. In that, you know, somebody once said here in the studio, if you don't heal, you will repeat. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is the time to repeat, I mean, to heal and do the process, do whatever process that takes for you. And you sound like that kind of person. You sound like you get that. So you sound like a wonderful person. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Yeah,
thank you. Good. Thank you so much.
You
guys are great.
Oh, Joan, well, thank you. And again, I said serious, that invitation to come out here, hang out with us in the studio. You know, we had some guests last week. It was so much fun to meet them and to have them here. And and I hear your heart, and it enlivens my heart. Joan, you are a delight. Yeah. And so we are going to send you a copy of the Life Recovery Workbook for Grief. And I just want to encourage us all out there, you know, life on planet Earth for any given amount of time is going to come with grief. And it's just such a reminder. In Isaiah, Jesus is referred to, or the Messiah is referred to, as a man who is acquainted with many sorrows. And so I like to say it like this. We better get acquainted with the man who is acquainted with many sorrows when we're in sorrow.
We get a question from James, and the question is, how can I approach the conversation with my fiance that I'm scared that she's enmeshed with her parents and I won't be a priority? He recently got engaged to the love of his life, and she's been living with her parents since she was born, never left the home. Now we're in a serious relationship, and I'm scared that she's not aware of the enmeshment she has with her parents. I believe her parents have some codependency, controlling, manipulative tendencies, but are not willing to admit it. And I'm afraid that I will not be a priority. My needs will not be considered, and her parents' needs and feelings will go before ours, before mine. And I do my best and bend to her will and compromise, but she does not do the same at times. Her parents often make her feel bad and guilty if she goes against their views and opinions. My concern is that she's more concerned about pleasing them than losing me. How can I approach this conversation? Well, Jim, how about you start on this one?
I love that he brought that up, because sometimes when you're even doing premarital counseling, you don't get to that place. And yet I find that in premarital counseling, that when you have those kind of conversations, those are the breakthrough type conversations. So, he's got to bring that up. That's a conversation you have before you get married, not just after you get married. And so you have that conversation before. And I would strongly suggest to James that he makes sure, you know, I hope he's getting premarital counseling. You know, there's a study in Oklahoma by the state that says you have a 31% better chance of staying married if you get premarital counseling or premarital education. In fact, there are several states now in the United States that will give you free, wedding license, marriage license, because if you'll get the counseling. So that's how key it is. So James can have a conversation. He can have a conversation with her. That may work. But he might want to have a conversation with a moderator, the counselor, the pastor, somebody who says, what are we going to do? You know, Jesus was very clear. A man will leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So what Jesus was saying, although he's speaking on several levels there, but leave, you know, and they talk about even in the old days, leave and cleave, you know, be bonded. The word, that is bonded. You'll be bonded to your spouse. Well, his wife is going to have to leave her parents. That's not easy. You know, I don't think I did a good job with that. When Kathy and I would have tension the first year of our marriage, and I was a youth pastor at the time, I would go home. And I never told my parents that we're having a fight. I just go open the refrigerator, and it was comfort to be there and talk with them. And then, you know, I hadn't left. And finally, then we moved to Princeton, New Jersey, where I was going to grad school. And that was really good for me, because I hadn't done that. Well, this woman needs to do that. But, you know, it's a really normal thing. He's picked that out. And again, how great that she's lived with her family, that her family is that tight. I mean, a lot of families aren't like that. His job is to protect his marriage coming up and honor his in-laws. And in doing that, I honestly think that James has a shot at really, you know, being a transitional generation. He and his wife to be, you know, can now, you know, create some great, you know, family times. But he's going to have to make sure that that's brought up. They're on the same page. Get on the same page.
Yeah. I love that. We'll hear from Jackie after the break. You know, we're going to talk a little bit about enmeshment, because he can describe it, right? And what does it feel like? What does it look like? Maybe you are in an enmeshed situation and you don't even realize it, but you can feel it. But I love what you are suggesting, Jim. You know, marriage is more than just the wedding cake. And Steve always says that you do really well until you eat that wedding cake and then everything changes.
Yeah. So James is feeling like the family that he's about to marry into is enmeshed. So enmeshment is just this level of closeness that there's no breathing room. And some of our families are super close and they do everything together. And that's great. And it can be healthy to a point. When a family is enmeshed, it's disordered. People aren't able to think for themselves. There are these family codes and these family themes that you're locked into. And so it's really hard to be a new person coming into that. We want to be more diffuse where people can safely and securely come and go in the relationship, have their own life, but then come back together and enjoy each other. The first thought that I had was, what is James's family like? Sometimes we marry into a family that is very close and we come from a family that isn't. And so they look disordered. That looks crazy to me. You guys do everything together. So that was the first thought that came up for me, would be for James to take a step back and just check inside and make sure that he's not feeling the way he's feeling because he doesn't have a similar relationship with his own parents. The other thing is that premarital counseling, oftentimes people will go and they've already made up their mind, so they're not really open to talking about the hard things. Go to premarital counseling and talk about this. Bring it up. Have the conversation. I love that this is a issue that you're finding as a fiance rather than as husband. And if you don't feel like you can bring this issue up and have a conversation with her, you should probably not get married right now, because this is important and you're already feeling like she's going to choose something other than you and not prioritize you. She may need to have a conversation about the fact that you expect to be prioritized. And so having a good premarital counselor, I think, is a big important step in having them to be able to walk through this conversation and do a comfort circle. I recommend reading How We Love. I think it could be great for the both of you to work through How We Love before the wedding.
Mm-hmm. You know, he mentions a lot in that email about how afraid he is. Mm-hmm. He's afraid that they're controlling. He's afraid that she won't put his needs first. You know, there's a lot of fear that goes into a new relationship, even though they've been dating and they're getting married. That fear starts to pop up and we have to pay attention to it.
And there's some ideals at play here, too. Like, he has an ideal marriage in his mind. He has an idea of what marriage is supposed to be. And I've sat with people so many times where they've said, this isn't a real marriage. And I say, did you say I do and get a marriage certificate? That it's a real marriage. Right. It's just not the one you thought you were going to have. And so he's dreaming and planning and envisioning what his marriage is. Are they doing that together? We make vision plans and strategic plans for organizations, for our jobs, but we don't do it for our marriage and for our family. And they probably need to sit down and create a vision.
You're so right, Jackie. And what happens is we need to do that before. Mm-hmm. And really, even things like, so what are we going to do for Christmas?
Yes.
What are we going to have Thanksgiving with them every year? Yeah. Or are we going to do some of our own things when we have children?
Yeah.
You know, those kinds of questions. And that actually may ease some of his mind, because mm-hmm. she may go, oh, no. We're not going to get up at 6:30 in the morning and go over there for Christmas morning. We're going to have our own, you know, Christmas, whatever it might be. But make some of those plans ahead of time. You can always break those plans.
Right.
But make some of those plans. Not every vacation is with them, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. Every Sunday, maybe they won't go to dinner. Mm-hmm. And who knows, maybe they will. But there's a psychological term called individuation that actually Henry Cloud writes on really, really well. But basically, if she's only lived at home and she's enmeshed with her family, as he describes, then she's going to have to, you know, become her own person. And, you know, sometimes it's a benefit to become your own person before you get married, because there's going to be a crash in, you know, in the relationship. But he has to understand, if that's the case, then she actually has to become her own person. And then they become kind of, you know, the Bible talks about, you know, two become one flesh. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes they have to become one away from parents to come to be really have a intimate relationship, meaning a connected relationship. So that's something that he's going to want to bring up and kind of understand and get some discernment from probably that counselor.
Yeah,
I love that. You know, individuation. Bruce and I are celebrating 40 years of individuation. No,
we were in our 36th year, but that's so important for a woman who's never lived outside of her parents' home and outside of the authority of her father.
Yeah.
to then go to marriage, she hasn't differentiated. No. She hasn't individuated.
No. Right.
And then 20 years into the marriage, she wakes up and realizes her kids are grown. His business right. is going well. And she's just trying to figure out who she is. And a lot of times that's when couples end up in my office.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so having her being in therapy before the wedding could really help them prevent some of those hurdles.
You know, we gave our kids that gift. All three of – I have all daughters, so we had no hormones or drama in our life. But we gave our kids all the gift of counseling. Mm-hmm. And we laughed because our daughter, Christy, instead of sick, we gave them all six sessions. She said, now the counselor thinks we need two more. and of course, I went, it's all about us, Kathy. Yeah. We're causing this. We might as well pay more. Yeah. But it is the thing where even some of the listeners could do that for their children mm-hmm. Who are getting engaged. Or actually, like you say – it's something I believe in pre-engagement, mm-hmm. you know, counseling. It might be with a pastor. I mean,
I
you
agree.
Know, but have those kinds of conversations before because, you know, you get married. And if you haven't dealt with those issues, man, it's going to be a tough.
For better, for worse is a real thing.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
can't imagine what the worst thing is if you haven't taken time to imagine.
It's very
and we
good.
Just say yes.
Very good.
And recognizing the fear that goes into new relationships, like mm-hmm. I said before, but also everything from, you know, she's going to feel it. Like you said, Jackie, she's got a new experience. You know, one of the things that I've talked to couples about in premarital counseling is the division of labor. Like yeah. who is doing what? Because mm-hmm. a lot of times when you come from mom and dad's house, you're not thinking about taking the trash out or who's paying the water bill or anything like that. And those basic things can really trip up a couple in those early years because yes. they start to panic. It's like, wait a minute. You know, it's funny because I remember a story that someone told one time about the first dinner that she made, and she had the bottle of ketchup and the bottle of mustard on the table. And her husband thought, oh, my gosh, what, were you born in a barn? Well, his mother, you know, had all the fine china and would put the ketchup in little dishes and the mustard in little dishes with a little silver spoon. Well, she didn't come from that kind of family. And that was like their first fight. Yeah. So you just never know what's going to trip you up. But going into marriage, you just know that you're going to learn a lot. And if you can be open and be able to have some key support, whether it's another couple that isn't your parents, because that's usually helpful, or even, you know, to have friends who are early in their relationships. I know that it is the great adventure, but it can also, you know, feel like you don't have a GPS. But that's why we're here. We want to help you. We have our marriage intensive. Whether, you know, we have had engaged groups that have come to our marriage intensive, our intimacy of marriage. We do teach about how we love the attachment styles. And attachment styles in relationship, in marriage, I mean, is really profound. Mm-hmm. You know, we know it because we teach it all the time. But like you had mentioned, Jackie, the comfort circle is a great structured conversation for couples to continue to grow closer and closer and have a deeper understanding mm-hmm. of what life is like for the other person, because we usually put our presumptions on our spouse. I know maybe you guys don't do that, but mm-hmm.
Projection is it definitely happens.
No, totally.
It does happen.
Yeah.
And mind reading too. We think that they can understand what we are feeling and thinking, and it just doesn't occur.
Yeah, it's
that
really
way.
Not a form of communication. Mind reading is not a form of communication.
Right. And we think we know what they're thinking
sure.
and how they would respond. So we've had yeah. a whole argument with them and made decisions yeah. based on conversations they weren't privy to.
Exactly.
Yeah. I brought a pot in with me in the studio today, just a typical pot that you would cook things with. And I want to tell you how I use it in my office. Recently, I had a couple come in and they were dealing with the impact, the pain of sexual betrayal. There had been pornography and some cyber sex and things that had gone on in their relationship. And as I was sitting with the couple, I noticed that every time, in this case, the wife was the betrayed partner, every time she started talking about how she was hurting, the husband would pull away or he would start deflecting and talking about something else. And even one time he ended up putting it on her. And so I thought, this is interesting. So I pulled out a pot that I have and I just said, hey, I said, basically, this is what's going on. You both are right now sitting in a boiling pot of water. Now,
your wife is in pain from the sexual acting out that's gone on. And as she's talking, you begin to feel pain in yourself because of hurting her. And what I'm observing is you either jump out of the pot or you start making it about her in the pot as if she's hurting you, but she's the one who's hurting. So I explained to them that we can often have feelings about somebody else's feelings, and that can complicate the healing process. So I reminded him, I said, hey, the bottom line is you're the one that turned on the flame. You're the one that turned on the stove to even create the boiling water. And it's my goal to help you sit in the hot pot with your wife as she's starting to talk about the hurt, the betrayal, the deception, the pain, and the heartache she's had because of what you've done. I want to help both of you. I want to help you, the one who betrayed, learn how to have some empathy and really hear her. Not tell her to stop, not try to quiet her down or tap her down, but really listen, not with your only ear portals. I want to help you learn how to listen with your heart and to be able to speak back words of understanding and empathy and ownership. And I'm telling you, Becky, things began to change because you get it, right? And I think Jesus often taught in parables. He taught in these simple messages so that we could actually get it. And as that couple started getting it, he realized that it was okay for him to have feelings about her hurt and pain. That was a normal part of the healing process for both of them.
You know, we don't want to get into the hard, hot water. We want it just to be easy. We just want it to be over with. And such a great word picture. You know, if you're struggling with something like this and you need a way to get out of the hot water, we can help you. We've got steps, pathways, people, all kinds of things to help you.
Welcome, New Life family, friends, listeners, wherever you're listening and whatever device and medium you're listening through, we welcome you. Really, the heart of our mission, you know, is bringing hope and healing in life's hardest places and darkest places. And the truth of the matter is that we are all going to encounter it in one sense in one time or another. And out of the many different things that we offer here at New Life, one of the things we offer is this emotional freedom workshop. And to be honest, it's a little near and dear to my heart because I've been a key person helping design and develop and speaking at that thing. But I also know that emotional freedom, just that word or that combination of two words, can be a little bit unclear. So JJ, when you hear emotional freedom, what comes to your mind? How do you understand that?
Yeah, so I would start with the idea that there is nothing, absolutely nothing in my story or the story of someone else that is getting in the way of me experiencing all that God has for me. Right. Mm. So it's the idea that Jesus presented in John 10 that, you know, the thief comes to steal, kill and destroy. But I have come. Why? That you would have life to the full. Right. And there's so many things that get in the way of me experiencing that full life. Emotional freedom sets me free from all of those things that want to cling to me, all those things that want to trip me up.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good. And Sherry, for you. You hear those two words. What comes to mind?
You know what comes to mind is that the opposite of emotional freedom is like emotional frozen. You know, I think there's a lot of us that are afraid to have feelings because we're afraid that if I start to open up my heart or I start to go back and touch that story, just like you talked about, JJ, I start to go back and look at a wound that somehow that wound is going to consume us or take us out or we're going to relive it. We can't relive it. We can't because it happened in the past. But that pain, that hurt, those emotions get frozen in our bodies and it can keep us stuck from the very freedom that we're all looking for. And so it, you know, oftentimes when I'm working with people and I'm doing EMDR, eye movement dissociation reprocessing, we hit their top traumas of all time. And they're so, you know, understandably, there's a lot of fear to go in mm-hmm. and do that. But, you know, let's say we're working on a target. At the end of 4 or 5 sessions, they're like, that doesn't hurt like it used to hurt. Yeah. And I'm like, isn't right. it amazing? You're ready to go to number two, you know? So there's there's change that can happen.
And I think the important thing with that is that emotions are an essential part of our life. And in scripture, there is only really 2 primary emotional experiences that come with deep warnings, fear and anger. Those are the ones that keep us trapped and stuck and in destructive places and cycles more than anything else. Emotional freedom is not about eliminating emotions. It's about emotions going from being a master in our life to a servant in our life. Emotions are a great servant and a terrible master. And so what we want to be able to do is get into our story, as you were saying, Sherry, and be able to resolve the things that are driving the fear and anger in our life. So please, if you're struggling in this area, sign up today, Emotional Freedom Workshop.
Our final call is Paula, sharing that her stepdaughter is involved with a polyamorous relationship and wondering how to navigate their relationship with their daughter and their daughter's multiple partners during the holidays. Lastly, Alice Benton shares about blessings and how focusing on the good has surprising benefits.
We're going to go back to the phones and we're going to go to Paula listening in Indianapolis, Indiana on YouTube. Paula, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
Good. Glad that you called in. Talk to us. What's going on?
I'm from a blended family. I'm the mother of a blended family, and we've been together for several decades now. And my stepdaughter is, we learned about a year ago, is living in a polyamory triple relationship. And she's married to the man, and there's a third female partner. And she has a little one-year-old boy and is pregnant with a second boy. And then there's 4 other kids that are also involved in this family lifestyle. And initially, when we first found out, my husband and I, we, you know, told her of our love for her. We couldn't embrace this lifestyle. We talked about God's plan. She knows us. She knows mm-hmm. we come from a God viewpoint and perspective. And so initially she estranged herself from us for several months, and then she started contacting and reaching out again. And so we've got a relationship with her and our grandson, and we don't have one with him. He's never really connected with us or made an attempt to mm-hmm. connect with us. So yeah. We had him, you know, certainly embraced him and cared for him before this all came out. So I guess the question is, there are other children involved, and mm-hmm. They try, you know, when we see them on FaceTime or so forth, they always want to say hi. And of course we say hello and we welcome them. And
for sure. And so Paul, let me jump in here. So we get a good picture of what's going on mm-hmm. here. What's the question for us today?
The question is going forward for my husband and I, because we don't want to embrace it, but it's kind of conflicting with who we are as Christians and loving other people and embracing and welcoming. And so for us to make this boundary of not having them all over for the holidays or having all these.
And what you mean by all, let me jump in. So, because we got to leave some time for us to answer the question. So, part of it is that your stepdaughter and her multiple sexual partners, correct?
One being her husband and the other a third partner, yes.
Okay. And how do we navigate the relationship with them?
That's the question,
Okay. So, Paul, let us jump in, okay? So, Jim, this is a really complex one.
Right.
Okay.
And it's amazing how often we hear something like this, mm-hmm. too. Paula, I think you're doing a great job. And now that doesn't mean it feels good. And it doesn't mean, you know, there's easy answers. But here's what I like about it. In this blended family, you're showing them still love. You're talking to the grandson. You're saying, you're welcoming the kids and saying that. Because again, you can't fix this. Mm-hmm. And I want you to hear this really loud and clear, that you are a parent, even in a blended family, a parent is not defined by poor choices of a child. And we sometimes define our own selves that. So you got to understand that. No, I think it's messy, and you'll have to decide. And I wish there was a manual on this, and there's not. But I think when you really look at scripture, I think Jesus led with love. He practiced kindness. He held his boundaries. And so there's going to be times when you and your husband are going to have to say, okay, what do we do for Christmas? Who do we invite, and how does this work? But I do think it's possible to embrace them without embracing their behavior. And I really want you to kind of think of that. What can we do to embrace them without, because she came back. She estranged from you, but she came back and wants a relationship. I think it's really possible to embrace them without embracing their behavior.
Yeah, and I think there's room for honest conversations mm-hmm. around
exactly.
that. Yeah.
And I think she's done it. She said she did. I like that.
Absolutely. Paula, this is a really complicated situation, but I love what you said, Jim. You know, embrace them without embracing the behaviors. Have an honest conversation with them about Christmas, mm-hmm. about gatherings, about this, and what you need in your home, Paula. I want to encourage you greatly on that. We're also going to send you a copy of Jim's book, Doing Life with Your Adult Children. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, mm-hmm. what a challenging, complicated, layered situation that it's even a struggle for us sometimes on radio. It's like, do we have an easy answer here?
Well, right. And obviously, like, she's trying to figure out, Paula, you're trying to figure out holidays and how do we be accepting without condoning? And that's, like you've been saying, it's very layered and difficult. And so sometimes we have to kind of try some different ideas on for size. Like, mm-hmm. do you just invite daughter, husband, and grandchild and not include the others? And then how would that go over? And yet, we were saying at the break, we've not seen these types of situations play out over time and survive. And so you want to look at the long game.
Yeah.
And
oh, that's really good. Yeah.
Right, Jim, you were talking about that. Be the safe place for her to come and land. So you want to keep relationship open. And maybe you are honest with her and discuss different ideas. We want to include you. We don't know how to include everybody and feel comfortable.
Well, you know, people support what they help create. So sometimes mm-hmm. even asking, saying, look, you know us. We love you. That's not going away. However, we need some help with this because, you know, we don't embrace what you're doing in terms mm-hmm. of these choices. But we also want you to know we love you. So help us how do we do Christmas?
Right. Let's talk about some ideas.
Yeah. Give us some counsel. I mean, it sounds so funny, but give us some counsel in terms of how we who have, you know, a biblical worldview.
Daughter, how do you envision it?
Exactly.
And we need to kind of go back and forth with these ideas.
I don't think it's ever a problem to say, look, we love you. Here's what we have a problem with. We don't know how to fix this. Do you have any ideas? Mm-hmm. And she may not have an idea. She may get mad.
And maybe you do something separate from Christmas.
Exactly.
Oh, that's a great idea.
You know, let's go and we'll have a park day and everybody can come.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that way we're not, you know, bringing it into the rest of the family. And
right. No, it's a good idea. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Alice Benton. I'm one of the co-hosts on New Life Live. I want to encourage you today to consider engaging in reviewing your blessings. Now, this can be done verbally with your spouse, with your children. It can be done in journaling. It can also be done in a thank you note. I'm going to share some examples of how this works well and the benefits of doing so. I was driving one day and feeling like I was getting all the red lights. It seemed like every time I was going to cross the street, I hit up against another red light. I was getting really annoyed and frustrated and thinking, why do I always get the red lights? But then I started to wonder, how realistic was that? Was I truly hitting every single red light? The truth was, no, I wasn't. I was getting some green lights. I do think I hit more red lights that day than green, but they weren't all red. Our brains have a tendency to look for evidence that supports the way we think and the way we feel, and we tend to ignore evidence to the contrary. So when we're feeling anxious, depressed, or irritable, we're sort of wired to notice things that support the way we're feeling and support the way we're thinking. So on days when I feel like everything is against me, I'm going to notice all the red lights and I'm going to ignore or overlook the green lights in my life. The Bible encourages us to proactively focus on the good because in our broken state, we have such a tendency to focus and take in the negative. So my husband and I, on a regular basis, will take a walk together and one of us will say, let's go through our blessings list. And we just talk about the positive in our lives, the things that we're grateful for, the things that are going well. I try to do this with my children. I also try to write thank you notes to people in my life, especially anybody that I'm in conflict with or that I'm struggling with in relationship. Because the benefits of doing this, it helps us feel better focusing on the positive. It decreases anxiety, depression, and irritability. It builds connection and it strengthens our faith. Because if we believe, as the Bible tells us, that everything that's good comes from God, and we start listing off all the good that we have, it can help us hold more securely, more firmly to the truth that God will meet all of our needs and that He loves giving good things to His children. So do your blessings list today. See how many things you can come up with and how you feel when you're done. And you can call us here at 1-800-NEW-LIFE. We want to help.
Our upcoming November events are Every Man's Battle, November 1st through 3rd in Orange County, California, and then December 6th through 8th in Dallas. Restore Conference is November 1 through 3 in Washington, D.C. And again, our Club New Life Zoom is Saturday, November 9th at 8 a.m. Pacific Time and 11 a.m. Eastern Time. You know, we started with A Story on Blessings by Jim Burns, and we ended with A Story on Blessings from Alice Benton. In this time, this month, we hear a lot of people talking about gratitude and Thanksgiving. And I just want to encourage each and every one of you to think about how God has provided for you and your family. His faithfulness has been evident, and sometimes we can get distracted by the things that are going on around about us in this new year of election topics and hurricanes and all the stuff that we have just been hearing, wars, rumors of wars. There's so much that can get us distracted from being grateful for how God has provided for us. Let's continue to be mindful of the ways that God has provided and that His faithfulness is worth celebrating. We are grateful for each and every one of you. Please connect with us. We're praying for you, and we want to hear from you as well. God bless you.